Hi there, and welcome to Scandalous. This is a podcast about the most scandalous people and events in history. I'm your anonymous host, M, and each episode I'll be bringing you stories of the disgraceful, heinous, outrageous, scurrilous, shameful, shocking, and slanderous.
Content warning. This episode contains detailed references to the occult, witchcraft, black magic, Satanism, sexual assault, incest, abortion, torture, animal abuse, and murder, including child death. Please proceed with extreme caution. For our Louis XIV bonus episode, we're going to be discussing the most scandalous part of his reign, L'Affaire des Poisons, or the Affair of the Poisons. It was a murder conspiracy involving poison that reached all the way to the top, into the inner circle of Louis le Grand. Okay, so before we start, I want to let everyone listening know that this is a really big story, like really, really big. There are entire podcasts devoted to one serial killer or other true crime events involving only a handful of victims. Jack the Ripper, for example. The event we're going to be discussing this episode included over 300 arrests and ended with 36 executions. I'm going to do my best to cover the most that I can. If you'd like way more information on this subject, I highly recommend my favorite book on it, Holly Tucker's book, City of Light, City of Poison. As I said, the scandal took place in France in the late 17th century, during the reign of the infamous Sun King, Louis XIV. Louis ruled during a time of direct and very personal monarchy. He was the absolute master of his dominions. He was called the Sun King because he viewed himself as the sun, the center of the French universe, and all of France orbited around his infinite majesty. Today, Paris is a beautiful city known for its style and culture, largely due to Louis XIV. In the early 17th century, when he came to power, Paris was one of the most populous cities in Europe, but it was also extremely cramped, filthy, and violent, and the justice system was a tangled, archaic mess inherited from the medieval period. Violent gangs, pickpockets, and con artists of all kinds roamed the streets of Paris in the early 17th century, and small, easy-to-conceal handguns became readily accessible around the same period. I imagine early 17th century Paris to be similar to America's Wild West era. It was utter chaos and a complete embarrassment to the crown. Louis XIV did not like chaos. He was pathologically obsessed with balance and order, just like the solar system he viewed himself as the center of. He made it his mission to reform Paris, to make it a jewel in his crown. He began by outlawing guns in the city for all but nobles. He also created new laws to rein in gambling. He mandated that every corner of every street in the city be lit at night by large torches. This is why Paris is known as the City of Lights. It was the first major city in modern Europe to be completely lit at night. Louis did a lot more to enhance the city, which I won't go into here as it doesn't really pertain to our story. But he did do one more very important thing, which is very relevant. He created the first modern police force in the city and appointed its first lieutenant général, or today what we would call a chief of police. This man was Gabriel Nicolas de la Reynie. This is a lot of context, I know, but it's important because Louis' cleanup of the city is what ultimately uncovered the scandal we're discussing today. And the first police chief of Paris was the man we have to thank for untangling the web of this grand conspiracy. Let's talk about poison. 17th century Parisians had plenty of types to choose from if they were so inclined. Besides arsenic, which was undetectable, and a household cleaner that could be easily purchased, there were also more natural poisons from animals like snakes and toads. One could also use an overdose of a drug like opium, or plants like hemlock or deadly nightshade to poison a victim. Many poisons couldn't be detected with any kind of accuracy at the time, as they are these days. In a pinch, one could test suspected poison on an animal, or several, to verify its toxicity. This happened on multiple occasions during the investigations in the poison affair, and I am not going to mention or describe them any farther in detail than I just did. Even having the precaution of something like a taste tester wouldn't save a person from a poison like arsenic, though, which could be given in small doses over a long period to devastating effect. It literally burned a person from the inside out. Arsenic could be added to food or drink for the best chance at killing someone, but it could also be absorbed by touch or inhalation. Arsenic powder could be sprinkled on clothing or cloth accessories like the gloves or handkerchief of an intended victim. Sadly, the effects of most poisons were often symptomatic of a number of different illnesses, so it was often overlooked as a cause of death. It is impossible to know just how many deaths over the course of history have secretly been the result of poisonings. It was common enough that when Louis XIV's beloved sister, Henriette Anne of England, died mysteriously at the age of only 26, she thought she had been poisoned, and rumors persisted for years that she had been murdered by her own husband or her husband's male lover. This was a tricky political situation for the Sun King, as Henriette Anne was also the much-beloved sister of Charles II of England. She had married into the French royal family, but she was still an English royal princess first and foremost. There were riots in England when the people heard the news. They believed their princess had been murdered by the French or Austrians. Louis immediately had an autopsy done by 6 doctors, 3 of whom were French, 3 of whom were English, in an attempt to ensure the validity of the assessment. The French surgeons almost completely botched the autopsy with their lack of skill, according to the English doctors. While the results of her autopsy were extremely suspicious, the doctors could not verify any poisons had been used, so the case was closed. Charles II did not believe the results of the exam and always thought that she had been murdered. Though modern forensic analysts have suggested several possible natural causes for her death, including a burst ulcer, the truth will probably never be known. The poison scandal began with the death of a con man called Saint-Croix. Contained in the late man's possessions was a box of mysterious substances and a letter stating who they belonged to. The substances, it turned out, were poison, and the person who Saint-Croix said owned the box was his lover, the noblewoman Madame de Brinvilliers. The beautiful and highly regarded Marquise de Brinvilliers' late father and 2 brothers had all died mysteriously years previously, and it looked like the mystery had finally been solved. Looking back, it seems like it should have been a bit more obvious that Madame de Brinvilliers should be a suspect in her father and brother's untimely deaths, as she was the only one who had access to all 3, who had all died of the same mysterious illness. But in those days, scientific and medical knowledge was not quite advanced enough to be able to tell the difference between a poisoning and a natural illness. And though we today may find it unbelievable that the Marquise was not suspected, we have to remember that in this period, the majority of people still believed in the actual nobility of the noble class. They also believed that one's physical appearance directly reflected the goodness of one's soul. It was beyond their belief system to think that a distinguished noblewoman from a good family, and as flawlessly beautiful as the Marquise de Brinvilliers, could be a murderer. Never mind kill her own family members. It was a complete shock. To make matters worse for her, once Brinvilliers realized she was in trouble, she had fled the country, making her appear even guiltier. Then, one of her servants, who was also under suspicion, also fled. The chief of police sent out a small gang of spies who eventually tracked the man down. He was found to be in possession of a number of lethal poisons.
He eventually admitted, under torture, to helping Madame de Brinvilliers poison and kill her two brothers. She had given him the poisons, which he had slipped into her brother's food. He did this in exchange for a high position serving in the Marquise's household, but had grown to hate her as he watched her enjoy the slow, agonizing deaths of her family members. The servant was subsequently executed. With this confession, Brinvilliers' fate was practically sealed. She was tracked down and arrested. Allegedly, investigators also found her written last confession as well, and it was both shocking and quite damning. According to Madame de Sévigné, a noblewoman who wrote detailed eyewitness accounts of court life in her letters, "Madame de Brinvilliers is not so comfortable as I am. She is in prison. Her confession has been found. It informs us that at the age of 7 years she ceased to be a virgin, that she had ever since gone on at the same rate, that she had poisoned her father, her brothers, one of her children, and herself, but the last was only to make a trial of a counter-poison. Medea was a saint compared with her. She has owned this confession to be her own writing. It was an unaccountable folly, but she says she was in a high fever when she wrote it, and that it was an act of madness or frenzy which does not deserve a serious thought." Apparently, as rumor went, the Marquise claimed to have been molested by servants as a child, and that one of her elder brothers had forced her into an incestuous relationship at the age of 10. Her father married her off to a man she didn't like, who spent them into debt, and when she began a love affair on the side, her father had the man arrested and dragged away to the Bastille by order of the king. This was why the Marquise hated her father and her brothers. She was a powerless and desperate woman who did what powerless and desperate women sometimes do. She turned to poison, arsenic in particular, the silent killer which would make her the sole inheritor of her family's wealth. It worked like a charm until Sainte-Croix's untimely death. He and Brinvilliers had been lovers, and he had been blackmailing her. I suppose it was his way of making sure he didn't become a victim of hers as well. She would surely never stop giving him money or kill him if she knew he had evidence of her crimes hidden away somewhere. In 1675, Brinvilliers was brought to trial for the murders. It was the scandal and trial of the century. The people of Paris talked of nothing else. The Marquise was found guilty of the crimes and sentenced to death. Madame Sévigné attended the execution, and though she was not able to personally witness it due to the massive crowd, she described it in her letters. In her words, "She was condemned yesterday, and this morning her sentence was read to her, which was to have her head cut off, her body burned, and her ashes thrown into the air. She was till 5 o'clock in the evening relating the history of her life, which has been more shocking than was even imagined. She gave poison to her father 10 times successively, but without effect, and also to her brother and several others, at the same time preserving the appearance of the greatest love and confidence. At 6 o'clock she was carried in a cart, with no other covering than her shift, and with a cord round her neck. Those who saw the execution say she mounted the scaffold with great courage." Let's talk about torture. Brinvilliers was subjected to la question, or the question, which was a polite term for torture. In this period, it was used more often as a form of punishment for the convicted than as an interrogation method. The belief at the time was that a person who was truly innocent of a crime would never admit to it, even under the worst torture, for fear of damning their immortal soul with a lie. If you admitted guilt, you must be guilty, and torture simply hurried that process along. It made complete sense by their Catholic logic. There were 4 types of torture common to the period. The strappado consisted of lifting a person up with ropes and then dropping them repeatedly until their shoulders dislocated, making their arms useless for life. The question d'eau, also known as the water cure, had a victim forcibly drink water or other liquid until they literally burst. Brodequins were a device attached to the legs and feet of a victim being hammered tighter and tighter until the muscles burst and the bones were literally crushed. The final method of torture, which was also often used as a means of execution, was the rack, in which a person's limbs would be stretched until dislocated, or until the limbs were literally torn from their bodies. Nobles were often exempt from such practices and treated much gentler than commoners. Many historians have stated as a fact that Madame de Brinvilliers was tortured horribly with the water cure, but there is no surviving evidence for such claims. It is not known what type or how much torture Brinvilliers suffered, but her servant had been racked before his execution. Madame Sévigné said, "At length it is all over. La Brinvilliers is in the air. After her execution, her poor little body was thrown into a large fire, and her ashes dispersed by the wind, so that whenever we breathe, we should all inhale some particles of her, and we may be all infected with the desire of poisoning, to our no small surprise." When Madame de Sévigné made her prediction that Paris would become infected by the desire to poison, she had no idea how accurate she was. You see, under torture, Madame de Brinvilliers had said something that bothered the new police chief. It scratched at the back of his mind, haunting him. Brinvilliers had said, during her confession, that half of the nobility have done the same things. If I felt like talking, I'd ruin them all. The affair really began to pick up speed in February of 1677, after the arrest of Magdalene de Lagrange on charges of forgery and murder. Lagrange worked as a fortune teller, but she also had a knack for seducing rich older men. She was accused of poisoning her current benefactor and forging a marriage certificate between them in an attempt to steal his fortune. After her arrest and imprisonment, Lagrange appealed to the authorities, claiming that she had information about other crimes of high importance. This may have just been an attempt to postpone her trial and sentencing, but she knew details of French army movements long before anyone should have. Was it just a lucky prediction, or was Lagrange a spy? My bet is that it was a good guess, as she was quite an experienced con woman. She ultimately claimed that she knew of a conspiracy to poison the king, but in the absence of any verifiable evidence, she was not believed. Lagrange was sentenced to death for forgery and murder on the 4th of February, 1679, and 4 days later, she was hanged. Around the same time, a lawyer visited his friend Marie Vigoureux's house to share a little wine and have his palm read by Vigoureux's friend, Marie Beauce. The lawyer enjoyed the stories the two con ladies told about how they scammed nobles. When Beauce got very drunk, as she did that evening, she liked to brag that she had made a fortune selling poisons to people who wanted to get rid of family members or husbands. These little potions were known as inheritance powders. Beauce claimed that night that she only needed to commit 3 more poisonings to become a rich woman. The lawyer went to the authorities with this information immediately. They devised a brilliant scheme. The wife of one of the police, dressed in her finest clothes, would go to Beauce's house. She would pretend to be a distraught victim of spousal abuse who wanted to do away with her husband. The ruse worked perfectly. 2 days later, the woman walked away from Beauce's house with a vial of poison, probably arsenic. Beauce had also said during her drunken rambling that she had helped a Madame de Pouillon attempt to kill her husband by poison. These claims brought the scandal to new heights as it connected the poisoners with the nobility once more. This drunken confession, along with the evidence collected in her home, sealed Beauce's fate and convinced La Reynie and Louis XIV that there was indeed a cabal of murderous poisoners working in Paris. Alchemists, fortune tellers, and magicians of all kinds across the city were subsequently rounded up and questioned by police. Some of them confessed under torture to selling poison, and they gave authorities lists of their wealthy clients.
Lachenny had to work carefully and quietly on his case against Madame de Pouliot, collecting evidence before arresting her. While questioning her servant, the police chief learned that Bose used frogs in her potions and got them from a woman named Anne Chéron. Chéron was then arrested and admitted that she had delivered a toad to Bose's home. She had then personally witnessed Bose perform a ceremony to permanently poison a wine glass. To do this, she fed the toad arsenic, then put it in the wine glass, and beat it until it urinated. And I quote, 50 people could drink out of the glass, even though it had been washed and rinsed, and every one of them will die. When Madame de Pouliot was finally arrested and her home was searched, little pouches full of a powder containing arsenic were indeed found. Pouliot was eventually found guilty of attempting to poison her husband and spent the rest of her life in a prison workhouse. During her interrogation, Marie Bose admitted to knowing Lacange. They had met, she said, at the home of the fortune teller La Voisin. Though Louis had cleaned up much of Paris, there were still sections of the city even the Sun King's glorious rays could not penetrate. La Voisin lived in one of these districts, in a crime hub known as the Street at the End of the World. Holly Tucker describes the locale in her book City of Light, City of Poison. Quote, in a darkened cul-de-sac, steps from the street at the end of the world, lay the Court of Miracles. A place of legend, it inspired both fear and curiosity in onlookers. An old and rotting house, half buried in the ground, served as the only entry point to the most notorious den of organized crime in Paris. To get there, visitors descended a steep and winding bridge that led to the front door. Inside, the shack opened into a large subterranean network of tunnels extending all the way to the city's ramparts. Rumor had it that more than 500 men, women, and children lived together without faith and laws in these squalid underground caverns. Every day, a motley army emerged from the Court of Miracles and fanned out across the city in search of loot. The Court of Miracles got its name from the beggars, for whom the show of their infirmities was mostly an act. At the end of the day, wrote one observer, they clean themselves up and become healthy and jolly in an instant, without any miracles. End quote. La Voisin was arrested in the morning of March 12, 1679. It was rumored that a fireplace in her courtyard was filled with the charred remains of the abortions she had given numerous women. One of her lodgers later accused her of bragging, while drunk, that she had given over 2,500 abortions to the women of Paris. Her method involved using a primitive needle to inject the milk of pennyroyal through the vaginal opening and directly into the uterus. Unfortunately, something had tipped her off to her imminent danger, and she seemed to have cleared her home and courtyard of any evidence. Under interrogation, she did not reveal much, besides knowing Marie Bose, whom she accused of being a poisoner. Lachenny ultimately, ingeniously, decided to interview the two women together, which ended in them both accusing each other and several other people. New names of several conspirators came to light, including two more noblewomen, Madame Le Ferron and Madame de Dreux. Bose claimed that Voisin helped both of the women kill their husbands. With this new list of suspects, Lachenny quickly arrested at least 30 more people. One of the conspirators Bose and Voisin had accused was a con man and black magician known as Le Sage, who convinced people that he could speak to Satan. When Le Sage was arrested, he was found with a bit of gray powder folded inside a paper bill, which was assumed to be the expensive poison diamond powder. The tiny diamond shards, after being crushed up, would supposedly cut up the interior of the body once ingested, resulting in a painful death. He confirmed to Lachenny that both women sold powders and beauty elixirs to the women of the royal court. He also knew about the cabal of poisoners, but claimed to know little else. The subsequent arrests of the two noblewomen, Madame Le Ferrand and Madame de Dreux, began a wave of poison panic all over Paris. "The smallest of accidents are being attributed to poison," said a visitor. "So many people remain in a stupor over the fear the arrests are causing." A newspaper reported that fathers are suspecting their sons and are observing closely all of their movements, and mothers are cautious around their daughters. Children are taking precautions against their parents. Brothers and sisters don't dare to eat or drink anything one of their siblings gives them. Madame de Sévigné wrote, "Everyone is scared. Thank God I never bought any makeup or had my fortune read." The court doctor stated that, "If they are going to punish everyone involved in magic and poison, all of the valets and servants of Paris are at risk." The scandal was now famous, as was La Reynie, who could not depart from his home without a horde of curious onlookers surrounding him. He required a personal escort of armed guards to protect him from this mob as he made his way through the streets of Paris. By this time, there were over 50 suspects sitting in prison awaiting trial. Now, Louis created his own secret court, separate from Parliament and the regular judicial system. Any future suspects would be tried in this private tribunal, known colloquially as the Chambre Ardente, or Burning Chamber. A wave of poison trials now began, which shocked and horrified the Parisian people. Marie Bose and Vigoureux were both swiftly found guilty of murder. They were to be burned alive and their ashes thrown to the wind. A third accomplice was sentenced to hang, but she would have one of her hands cut off first. After her sentencing, Vigoureux received the question. There is no surviving record of what horrors she suffered, but it must have been quite terrible, as she died from the torture. Marie Bose was executed very quickly after Vigoureux's death. She was tied to a chair, which sat on a pile of firewood and hay. The wood was lit, and Bose, screaming in agony, was burned alive. Dozens of men and women were subsequently tried and found guilty of collaborating with Bose, Voisin, and Le Sage. Some were poison makers, but others were accused of being witches, magicians, and abortionists. Many went to prison for life or were executed for their crimes. As Voisin and Le Sage sat in prison awaiting their trials, they continued to be interrogated, and their stories began to change. Voisin finally admitted to having supplied poison to Madame Le Ferrand, which was made by an associate, and said that Madame de Dreux had asked her for poison as well. Le Sage claimed that Voisin was lying. She had manufactured the poisons from the seeds of ryegrass, poppies, and mandrake root, and had given it to Madame Le Ferrand. She had also poisoned a bouquet of flowers for Madame de Dreux. Le Sage also had suddenly remembered the name of one of the ladies Voisin had sold poison to at the royal court. None other than Mademoiselle Désolée, sometimes lover of the king and personal servant to his favorite mistress, the Marquise de Montespan. Louis had a bastard child with Désolée and had favored her so much at one point that, had she been of noble birth, she may have rivaled Montespan as his favorite mistress. Instead, the former actress settled happily for expensive gifts and a high-ranking position at court in Montespan's entourage. Far from being jealous or even considering Désolée a potential rival, Montespan used the situation to her advantage. She had her trustworthy servant keep Louise occupied during her frequent pregnancies when she was unable to sleep with the king herself. This claim from Le Sage was stunning, as it connected the poisoners directly to the king's most intimate circle. Voisin also continued remembering new and disturbing facts. She now claimed that she knew much about certain persons of quality. She implicated Olympe Mancini, Countess of Soissons, another of Louis's former mistresses and a ranking member of his royal court. She claimed that Olympe had wanted to poison one of her rivals for Louis's affections. When Louis had made it clear to Olympe that he was no longer interested in her, because he was now in love with her younger, less beautiful sister, she did not accept defeat gracefully. Olymp threw awful, tear-filled tantrums, which Louis despised. Later, she married into the French nobility and became a regular fixture at the royal court. But she annoyed the king by constantly scheming and continued to create all kinds of drama. She was suspected of having poisoned her husband, who had died of a mysterious illness several years earlier. This made her a perfect target for a murder accusation. Voisin claimed that Olymp said she wanted her rival dead, and that if Voisin could not do that, she would take her vengeance even farther up, implying that she would attempt to harm the king. Were Voisin and Le Sage telling the truth? It was quite coincidental that the two had only remembered these new facts after being privately interrogated by the war secretary, the Marquis de Louvois. Coincidentally, Olympe and Montespan were two of Louvois' greatest enemies, and he was the type of unforgiving man who never forgot a slight, and he constantly schemed against them. He did not normally interrogate prisoners, and it certainly would not have been out of his character to make some sort of deal with Voisin and Le Sage in which they would implicate his rivals. Lachenie now arrested Olympe Mancini and her sister, Marie-Anne, the Duchess of Bouillon. Marie-Anne strutted bravely into her trial, arm in arm with both her husband, who she was accused of attempting to murder, and her lover, who she allegedly wanted to kill her husband to be with. The charges must have seemed ridiculous to the inhabitants of the royal court, as it was known quite publicly that Marie-Anne's husband knew and didn't care about her lover. He was happy to have any part of her that he could get. While she had her fortune read by Voisin and Le Sage, she claimed to be innocent of any desire or attempt to kill her husband. She made a valiant defense on the stand, answering Lachenie's questions with haughty defiance. When Lachenie asked why she wanted to kill her husband, Marie-Anne responded, "Kill my husband? Ask him what he thinks. He held my hand all the way to the door." Then she turned, speaking directly to the judges. "Messieurs, is this all you have to say to me?" When asked by Lachenie if she had ever seen the devil, she replied, "Monsieur, I see him right now. He is ugly and old and disguised as a judge." Marie-Anne's responses shocked both the judges and Ragny, who were left gobsmacked and practically speechless. They decided to dismiss the case against the Duchess, probably having no desire to go another round in the ring with Marie-Anne. Lachenie had learned the hard way what happened when one trifled with a Mancini. Olympe Mancini, having been made aware by the king of her imminent danger before her arrest, had fled the country. Louis stated to his niece, "Madame, I wanted the countess to flee. Perhaps I will have to make amends one day to God and to my people." Apparently, he did not believe the accusations. Olympe believed herself that Louvois was behind it all, reportedly saying, "Louvois is my mortal enemy. He will have me die on the gallows, or at the very least put me in prison." The Duke of Luxembourg, an officer of the crown, and coincidentally another of Louvois' enemies, was also arrested. The evidence in his case was deemed to be a forgery, but the Duke was exiled from Paris, as was Olympe. This action had a more lasting impact on Louis than he could have ever imagined. Olympe's talented son, Prince Eugene of Savoy, defected and joined the military of France's greatest enemy, the Austrian Habsburgs. He became one of the greatest generals of the day and was a constant thorn in Louis's side. Louvois, as the Secretary of War, had to experience the shame of his army being defeated many times by his greatest enemy's son. It seemed, in the end, Olympe finally was able to get her revenge against both Louis and Louvois. The arrests and subsequent treatment of these prominent figures was an outrage to the noble classes. Madame de Sévigné stated, "Everyone is questioning a little the wisdom of the judges, who were creating a stir by scandalously targeting such big names for such little things. Truly, there is hardly another example of such a scandal in a Christian court. A contemporary commented on the situation. All we need to do is burn the witches, the witnesses, and the judges, and all will be taken care of. It was now finally Voisin's turn to be judged. She was found guilty and sentenced to be burned alive. During her subsequent questioning, under torture, of course, she began to reveal more crimes. "For the sake of my conscience," she said, "I must tell you everyone who came to me seeking death. Debauchery was always at the heart of it all." She confirmed that one of her associates, La Père, had performed a large number of abortions. She confessed that she had lied and cheated La Père and her own daughter out of their full profits from the abortions, and she had also provided poison to a neighbor. Voisin then met her gruesome end, being publicly burned alive. Madame Sévigné witnessed this execution and commented, in her typical fashion, "Voisin gave her soul gently to the devil. All she did was pass from one fire to another." With the dramatic death of Voisin, Régnier and the populace of Paris may have felt that the poison scandal was finally coming to a close. But in reality, the most horrific details of the affair had yet to be revealed. It was at this time that La Régnier finally got around to interrogating La Voisin's daughter, Marie Marguerite. To nobody's surprise, Voisin had been an abusive, loveless mother, whom Marie Marguerite now hated. She had no qualms implicating her mother, especially now that Voisin was dead, and Marie Marguerite no longer had anything to fear from the woman. Marie told La Régnier that once she had spied on her mother and saw her with a man, who was dressed as a priest, and another man in a red wig, all chanting in a language she did not recognize. The man in the priest's robe stood before what looked like an altar. He lifted a wax figure above his head, wrapped in cloth, and then placed it in a small metal box. La Régnier immediately recognized the man with the red wig as Le Sage. It appeared as if Marie Marguerite was describing the trio casting a spell or holding some other sort of sacrilegious ritual. Magic was real in the 17th century, or at least the people of France believed it was. Many fashionable women had their palms or astrological charts read, which were considered innocent pursuits and not sacrilegious. Witchcraft and Satanism, on the other hand, were considered absolutely blasphemous. People also believed then in the idea of the Black Mass, in which Catholic rituals were inverted in an attempt to appeal to God's opposite, the devil. It was said that practitioners of this wicked ritual would sometimes sacrifice human virgins and even babies to Satan. Marie Marguerite also remembered accompanying her mother to a wealthy woman's house. They met in the garden, and Marie Marguerite watched while the two women chanted and walked around a fire, then buried a wax figure in the ground. She also confirmed for La Régnier that she remembered seeing Mademoiselle Désolée visit their home many times. But Marie was not finished with her revelations. She made another startling claim. She said that her mother and her mother's associate, Romanie, had been hired to kill Louis's latest mistress, the Duchesse de Fontanges, by selling her a pair of poison gloves. They were also going to hand the king a note laced with poison. And the person paying them to murder the king and his lover? Louis's previous favorite mistress, Athenaïs, Marquise de Montespan. Marie Marguerite claimed, and I quote, "Every time something new happened to Madame de Montespan that left her to worry about the king's diminishing good graces toward her, she came to my mother for some remedy. My mother told me that Madame de Montespan wanted to take everything to the extreme. She hired my mother to do disgusting things." Marie was still not finished with her revelations. She once heard her mother say to a friend, "Disappointment in love is a beautiful thing." Voisin then listed to her friend all of the services Madame de Montespan had hired her for. Voisin had made love potions, cast love spells, and arranged the services of Le Sage and a man named Guibourg. When the spells and potions no longer worked, Voisin made a wax effigy of the king. Montespan had stabbed it angrily over and over. At Montespan's request, one of the spells included Voisin writing the king's name on a paper, throwing it into a fire, and reciting the following incantation. Burn, fire! This is the body, the soul, the spirit, the heart, and the understanding of Louis of Bourbon. May he neither go nor come, rest nor sleep, until he fulfills the wishes of the woman who I name. It is difficult to imagine how stunned La Reynie must have been by these new accusations. Lagrange had claimed previously that there was a plot to kill the king, but nobody had actually believed it to be true. Could the girl be lying? It is difficult to conceive how Voisin's daughter, who appears to be smart and who understands the dangers to which she exposes herself, would want to invent and to put forward such strange and unbelievable things, wrote La Reynie. Louis was indignant when he heard the news of the accusations and directed La Reynie to remove any mention of Désolée and Montespan from the official record. The Sun King did not believe the accusation against his former lovers. In order to root out any truth in the claims, La Reynie arrested Philastre, a servant of Montespan's sister-in-law that Marie-Marguerite had mentioned. La Reynie was shocked when Philastre confessed to attending black masses held by Father Guibourg. She had also participated in seances, but this was not nearly the worst of her accusations. She claimed that, years earlier, she had been raped by another servant and become pregnant. In the middle of her labor, she had been kidnapped by a group of men who brought her to the home of the witch Madame Simon. They threw her to the floor and placed lit candles around her in the shape of a pentagram, then made Philastre hold a black candle while they chanted and cast spells. Once she had given birth, the witch Simone took her placenta and the newborn baby and disappeared. Philastre had never seen the child again. Simone denied the charges and accused Philastre of being the one who had done away with the child. The true bombshell dropped when La Reynie interrogated one of Father Guibourg's associates, a Father Leroyer. Leroyer confessed almost immediately. He said both Philastre and Simone had planned to use the child for profit, splitting the income made from the sale of both the placenta and the child. They sold the placenta as an aphrodisiac, but Leroyer did not know the ultimate fate of the child. Now it was Father Guibourg's turn to be interrogated. He confessed easily, stating, "I submit myself to the mercy of God and the king. It is true, I allowed them to take advantage of my weaknesses." He admitted to performing black masses, giving detailed descriptions of them. Two he had performed, he claimed, at the behest of Madame de Montespan, though he could not identify her directly because the woman's face had been covered both times. He had chanted a spell over the woman. "Azthroth, Asmodee, Prince of Darkness, I conjure you to accept the sacrifice that I now offer you in the form of this child." Guibourg had also provided similar services for Mademoiselle Désolée. He said he had created a love potion for the king by combining some of her menstrual fluid with male semen, and gave the disgusting concoction to Désolée to slip into the king's food or drink. Can you say ew? During her subsequent interrogation under torture, Philastre admitted the following. "It's true. I offered my child to the devil. I gave it to Simone." She said that Montespan had been disappointed with the magic spells that had worked so well previously and needed something stronger, as the king had become interested in a new infatuation, Mademoiselle de Fontange. Montespan wanted Fontange dead and for the king to love her as passionately as he once had. She submitted to performing a black mass, and Philastre's child had been the sacrifice. Though Philastre later retracted her confession, it was not enough to save her from condemnation and eventually execution. Later, another prisoner also claimed one of her babies had gone missing. She said that Guibourg had taken her child as well, telling her he would give it to a nice family, but she suspected something sinister had happened to it. La Reynier later learned from Marie-Marguerite that Voisin had sold magic potions concocted with human placenta, intestines, and the limbs of babies which had either been aborted or outright stolen from their mothers. She had also personally witnessed one of the child sacrifices. Guibourg had held a baby over a woman who was lying on the floor. He used a knife to slit the baby's throat, then collected the blood in a chalice as it dripped down, covering the woman on the floor. Marie-Marguerite claimed that he said the king's name as well as that of Madame de Montespan. Guibourg later claimed that he had cut the baby's heart out and given it to Montespan in a glass jar. Mademoiselle Désolée was subsequently interrogated, but denied all of the charges laid against her. La Reynie was never able to interview Montespan directly, as Louis had strictly forbidden it. La Reynie's head spun. He did not know where to go from here. He and Louis were both concerned about the political implications of the scandal if his mistress's names became connected to the matter. How would it look if Louis could not keep control of his own mistresses? La Reynie wrote, finally, "The number of crimes mentioned here stuns the mind. It is difficult even to presume that these crimes are possible. They seem so strange that I can hardly make myself consider them. It puts the mind in a strange agitation. This is as far as I am able to go. All the rest is outside my abilities and depends solely on God's inspiration on the king for his glory and the public good." Louis ultimately decided to convene a second secret court inside the secret court he'd already established. He, La Reynie, his advisor Colbert, and Louvois would decide each case themselves, privately, and condemn the prisoners as they saw fit. Afterwards, all evidence in the affair was to be kept secret by La Reynie, under lock and key, to be burned upon his death. And that's exactly what happened, for the most part. The rest of the prisoners awaiting trial were either dismissed, executed, or sent to prison for life, where they did hard labor and were not allowed to speak even to their guards. This would serve to keep them from starting rumors among the other prisoners, ensuring the affair would be covered up. Louis made it known that he considered the affair to be over. "We do not speak at all of poison. The word is banned at Versailles and all of France," wrote Madame de Sévigné. The king enacted new, harsh laws outlawing any occult practice and promised to severely punish anyone in France found to be a fortune teller, magician, witch, or poisoner. He also began to strictly regulate the sale and possession of poisonous animals and substances such as arsenic and mercury. In the end, Louis's secret court met 210 times. 442 people were interrogated, 218 of which were imprisoned. 28 of those wretched souls were sentenced to life in prison, and 34 of them were executed. How many of them were guilty? I gave my opinion on Montespan in the main episode. One more thought, though. Usually the truth of the most scandalous stories, even though it's not as fun, are much more mundane than what eventually becomes accepted legend. Beyond that, I'll leave you to be the judge. Mademoiselle Désolée's case was dismissed, and she lived comfortably for the rest of her life, away from court, in the house Louis had given her. Madame de Montespan had fallen from Louis's graces much before the affair of the poisons, but the accusations against her had sealed the deal for the Sun King. Montespan kept a room in her chateau for Louis, convinced he would eventually return to her. But he never did. As I mentioned before, all of the evidence and documentation in the case was to be burned upon La Reynie's death, And it was, by Louis himself. However, despite the king's attempts to cover up the affair, La Reynie had kept copies of much of his vast archive of information in his private collection of documents. Through a trick of fate, La Reynie's archives have been passed down to modern historians. The collection of papers even survived the French Revolution. A portion of the French archive was burned during the storming of the Bastille, but La Reynie's papers somehow remained untouched. We only know so much about the case because of La Reynie's final defiant act. Perhaps he believed, in the end, that posterity deserved to know the truth of what accusations were made. Perhaps history could be the judge, La Reynie and Louis could not. And this ends our whirlwind tour of Louis XIV, his times, and his scandals. As promised on Twitter, we will be staying in France for our next episode about an evil queen. See you next time, and happy Halloween! Thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions or just want to chat, you can reach out on Twitter, Facebook, any of the social media places. Just look up Scandalous or Scandalous History Podcast, and you will find us. I hope to hear from you!